Okay, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village, New York City. We're going to start this the way we always do. For those of you who have never been here before to the clubhouse, welcome. To those who have been here before, welcome home. We've had about 20 book events since we opened the clubhouse last June. We've had a couple of art events. Tonight, though, is our first true panel discussion where nobody's selling a book or anything like that. It's just a very interesting panel put together by my old buddy, Lee Lowenfish, who I've known for 25 years. And I'm going to let Lee take it from here because he could do this a lot better than I can. So take it away, Lee.
Well, thank you very much for coming out in a little bit of a drizzle tonight, but we knew there would be no rain out tonight. Now, the magic number, it seems, is 95. 95 days until the greatest phrase in the English language comes true again. The pitchers and catchers have reported to spring training. Now, in putting together this panel, I just discovered tonight that 95 is kind of a magic number, too. Because on my left, Joe Rigoli from the St. Louis Cardinals has been with the Cardinals for 30 consecutive years. On my far right, Billy Blitzer has been with the Cubs for 30 consecutive years, and Joe DeLuca on my near right was a scout for 35 consecutive years, so 30, 30, 35, 95, which is a great grade, too. So I want to introduce Billy, my oldest friend in the scouting profession, native of Brooklyn, Abraham Lincoln High School, Hunter College. He's been with the Cubs as an amateur scout and is now a professional scout covering teams from in the minor leagues for the Cubs. His great signings are Sean Dunston, who he knew since he was 12, and Jamie Moyer, who hopes to resume his career after Tommy John operation at the age of 49 with 267 wins in the bank. On my near right, Joe DeLuca has been a native of Babylon, Long Island, since he was 5 years old. We met many years ago out in the field. Joe is very active in the Babylon Historical Society. Last year, he was one of the members of the committee that honored the Argyle Waiters with a plaque. They were one of the first black baseball teams in the 1880s. Joe also was instrumental in the signing of Manny Ramirez for the Indians and Pete Hornish for the Orioles. And last but not least, Joe Rigoli, who was from Suffern, New York, and went to Fairleigh Dickinson, has been with the Cardinals for 30 years, now used to be the Northeast Scouting Supervisor, and is now a pro scout like Billy, covering American League East teams from high A to the majors. Joe's signings include his all-time favorite, Super Joe McEwing, who Met fans will remember, in the 28th round in 1992, and the closer from the World Series that just concluded, Jason Mott, who he signed out of in the 19th round as a catcher for Iona College in 2003. So I thought we'd begin the night. Joe also was just honored this past weekend in Baltimore in the Mid-Atlantic Association's Hall of Fame. Joe, we all know that baseball is a game which has a lot of losing and you have to accept it, but is this a dream come true to have all these honors and all this winning for this 1 year?
This has been a great year. For me, it's been a great year for the St. Louis Cardinals. I mean, to come down from behind 10.5 games, you know, Tony La Russa did a great job. You know, and part of that was our general manager, Don Mozeliak, you know, who in the summertime identified needs of the club. We made he made a big trade in the end of July, and you know the ball club clicked, and Tony did a great job, and you know here we are winning the World Series. You know, and it's been a great time. It really has been a great year.
Now, did you? Every scout will say that when you sign a player, you're looking for the major leagues. I mean, that's the goal. Now, when you looked at Jason Mott playing as a catcher in Iona, Did you envision this kind of development 8 years later?
Well, to say that that he was going to close out the seventh game of the World Series, that's certainly a dream. Just like it was Jason's dream, probably someday to pitch or play in the seventh game of the World Series. So, I'd certainly like that. But no, I didn't envision that happening. Although I did envision him getting to the major leagues. He had a great arm as a catcher, and he was a very good receiver. I knew he had a long ways to go with the bat, and part of my report was that if the bat didn't work out, that we should try to put him on the mound. There's been a lot of pitchers that were former catchers, Troy Percival, there's a Ricky Pitalico, and so catching is a valuable position, and I thought that he had a chance if he could figure it out with the bat to be a catcher. He made all-star teams in the minor leagues as a catcher, even though his average was low, but he had a great arm and a good receiver. So, but there was always that outside chance that, if that doesn't work out, let's put him on the mound and see what happens. And, I don't get credit for that. I get credit for maybe saying that he belongs on the mound, but everybody had that idea when he saw it, the arm strength that he had. So, I give a lot of credit to our player development people who nurtured his pitching. And so there's a lot of people involved in Jason's success. But, no, it was to say that I wasn't, happy to see him out there, no, I was very happy.
Billy, people always ask about Jamie Moyer. You said that of all the players you signed, he may have been the least talented. And yet, what did you see in him?
When I had seen him as an amateur in the York tournament in Pennsylvania on the Labor Day weekend, and at that time he was going into his junior year when he would be eligible, and he was facing 30-year-old ex-players, and he showed me that he knew how to pitch. If his curveball wasn't working, he would do something else, make an adjustment. Most of the times when you see amateur players, they'll just keep doing the same thing time and time again, make no adjustments. But here was a kid that at that age had a feel for what he was doing, had an idea, and he knew how to get people out. And one of the things I'm always asked about, Jamie, how hard did he throw when he was in college when you signed him? We used a different radar gun then, and at the time the radar gun that was used, the average major league speed was 85. The gun that we use today, the average speed in the major leagues is 89, but there's a 4 mile an hour difference. So at the time, Jamie threw 82, 83 on that gun. So in today's day and age on the gun, he would have been 86, 87. Today he throws 80, 81, 82, and that's his best. But what he does, and he talks about it, he changes speeds. His idea when he's on the mound is to have the hitters be so aggressive out there that they make mistakes and they get themselves out. And that's what Jamie does.
Joe, two Joes. Did you see Jamie too?
No, I didn't. No.
Joe, did you see him?
No, because it's way out of my territory. My territory was like down my block and down the next block. just kidding about that. But no, I did not see him. But
well, tell us.
I can understand the pride that he has in what that man did. I have about 10 I got to the big leagues that I got credit for some way or other. And the guy I take the most pride in is a guy named Jeff Schaefer, who came from Patchogue High School and then went to the University of Maryland. And he went to the University of Maryland because his dad had a big connection. He's a big-time lawyer, and he had a good connection there. But I was interested in him because he showed something that all major league players that I know have in them. They got a burning desire to beat somebody, and they want to succeed. And that runs right through them, every single one. If it doesn't, most of us guys, we go the other direction. But Jeff, when he went away, weighed 125 pounds after he got out of University of Maryland. And some people said to me he wasn't big enough and strong enough that he was going to wear himself out. And he was the kind of a guy, you had to rip the shirt off of him to get him to go inside after the game was over, after the practice was over. But he got to the big leagues. He got traded from Baltimore, and he got to the big leagues with Seattle, and he spent 4.5 years in the big leagues, 14.5 years in professional baseball. And to me, that's one of my prides, that young fella. And he's a successful businessman today in North Carolina. So I think we all have one of those stories like that, that we have one guy that we say, you know, that made it, that nobody thought was going to make it. So when somebody tells you, if you've got a grandson or a nephew or a son, he's too small, what the man is telling you is not the truth. He can't play. That's it. Because if he could play, they don't care how small he is. You just take a look at the big leagues and see some of the guys that are there. They're not all giants, although it'll shock you if you go into a major league locker room and see the size of some of these guys. They are big guys. But every once in a while, you see a little one.
And Joe McEwen, Joe Goley, does fit that category, doesn't he? Someone that you feel incredible pride in. In fact, a funny story, I thought you had Jay Haney, McEwen jersey here, and Jay says, oh, you're dreaming again, you know. But I believe Foley's Bar, you know, just a half mile from here, does have a Joe McEwen jersey. I didn't double check that, but I mean, how many times did you see Joe? Were you a small town in Pennsylvania?
Well, Joe's from Bristol, Pennsylvania, but he actually went to school in New Jersey at about 5 miles from my house in Morris County, New Jersey. He went to Morris County College. And, you know, it is a great story to see somebody like that, you know, reach the major leagues. But, you know, I think Joe DeLuca, you know, said it well before, that there was always a burning desire to do well. You know, Joe played shortstop at the time, and he, you know, we're always looking for what we call tools of the, you know, play the game, and, you know, and Joe could run, you know, he swung the bat good, he played good situational baseball when there was a chance to move the runner over, he did that, he was not a selfish ball player, he threw well enough, he did a lot of good things that, you know, that you like to see in a ball player, and every scout has their own little criteria, but I like to picture a ball player if he can play the major leagues. Now, what I do is, or try to do, is picture that player, you know, improving. And if I think that he's not going to play in the major leagues, then I have to make a decision that maybe he doesn't belong on my draft list, because I don't want to waste our time or his time when he could be going into a different profession. But I saw Joe as a middle infielder. He could run. He could do all the things that a middle infielder can do. And he plays shortstop. And there was another player that, when I wrote my report, I also thought that he would be moved over to second base. And, you know, the one story that I think is kind of a funny story in the sense that really projected what Joe was to become, and that is a super sub, was that when I signed Joe, I told him, I said, Joe, I've got in my report that you're probably going to be moved over to second base, so don't be surprised if that happens. Well, Joe, he said fine, and, you know, Joe was eager to go. He signed. He went out to Arizona. We had a team out there. And usually I try to contact a lot of the players that I sign just to see if they, you know, after a week or so, have they gotten settled, everything is okay. So I called Joe, and I said, Joe, everything okay? You settled out there in Arizona? He said, oh, yeah, everything's great. I said, well, you know, if they moved you over to second base, what position are you playing out there? He said, oh, center field. And I said, what? And he said, well, there was enough middle infielders and they didn't have a center fielder, so they asked, you know, who can play center. So I raised my hand. And so it was just kind of a, you know, a thing that would happen. I guess, you know, the outfielder didn't sign at the time, but Joe got used to playing different positions. And, you know, here he is, you know, played, had a great big league career, and now he's hired as the third base coach with the White Sox, and he's going to have a fine managerial career ahead of him.
It's the key to success in this game is forgetting yesterday, isn't it? And to live in the moment and projecting who's going to react to that in a positive way, whether it's victory or defeat. I mean, do you have any tips for how you project how somebody's going to mentally deal with how difficult this game is, because you play it every day and somebody loses every day?
Well, scouting, though, on the other hand, the more experience you have, the more players that you've seen, you compare the player today with who you've seen in the past and who has succeeded and who hasn't succeeded. And you try to figure out, why didn't that particular player succeed? Why didn't he have success? And you try to look at the player that you're looking at today and say, okay, if he's the same type of player, why will this youngster succeed, and he may not, you know. So actually, it's just the opposite. But the toughest thing for a scout to do, we go in to see a high school player, a college player, and we can look at tools. And the way things are today, the area scout is stretched very thin. You have bigger areas. They don't have part-time scouts or associate scouts like when I started. I've been scouting now 38 years. And when I started, you had a network. You had associate scouts or bird dogs. They don't get paid, but they're usually umpires or high school coaches or sandlot coaches, people that are going to feed you information. Then you had your part-time scout who might live in a particular area, and they get some money, and they're your eyes and ears because your area is so big that you can't be every place. There may be five different players pitching on Saturday, and you can't be in five different places if you have a couple of states. So you have the part-time scout, and you send them to those particular games. Well, in today's scouting world, the major league clubs have eliminated these so-called part-time scouts, and a lot of clubs have eliminated the so-called bird dogs or associate scouts. So you're out there yourself with maybe four or five states, and you're really spread thin. And the Major League Scouting Bureau, for those of you that don't know what that is, they represent all 30 ball clubs. They have their own scouting staff, and we get all their reports. So it was a cost-saving organization that was set up, and that's where I started with when the Bureau started. And they send the reports into the various organizations, so actually those guys work for you and you get their information. So when you go in as a full-time scout, the player may be on your draft list, but you maybe only get to see that player twice in the spring, believe it or not. Hopefully you have a history with him where you've seen the boy play maybe his freshman year, his sophomore year, and now a college player is eligible in his junior year. So you've seen him along the way, and you've seen him play during the summer, so that once or twice you do see him in the spring, you could make a decision. But a lot of times you haven't seen that player. And by watching him play only once or twice, you can evaluate his tools, but you don't know what's in here. You don't know what kind of heart he has. You don't know what kind of desire he has. So you make the best evaluation that you can by talking to his parents, by talking to the player, by talking to friends and girlfriends in the stands, because you're trying to gather as much background as you can, because the money that these kids receive today, it's unbelievable, and you really don't want to make a mistake. So that's really the toughest part, is to what's inside of them rather than the physical ability.
You started out, Joe DeLuca, when there wasn't a free agent draft, right?
Right. That was my beginning. And I think the free agent, the draft came in 65, around 64. That time.
Thanks to the signing of Rick Reichardt in 1964.
Am I right? Is it 65?
65 it started, yeah.
Well, anyways, yeah, and you had to be a nice guy. And they had different nicknames for different scouts. We knew each other then, too. And like we say, one guy got the nickname of the Candy and Flowers Scout. And when you walked into the house and she saw a box of candy and flowers, you knew so-and-so was there already. You say, this is a great point you make, Lee. By the way, before I go a minute further, I just wanted to tell you people about Lee a little bit. I know you guys know him because he's one of the big guys in his field, which is baseball research. And he does a great job. And I asked him to come to Babylon a couple of years ago when we honored the black first baseball team in the country, all black. And he came out. He made a little speech. Everybody there made a little speech. But it was a great honor for the village of Babylon. And these were not just guys that you rounded up and put them in a job in a hotel, which there was a big resort hotel there. These were outstanding baseball players, as good as the players you see today, because you can look it up. They played against the world champion teams at that time, Detroit Tigers of, I think, 1889 or something like that, and then the next year the Philadelphia A's or something, and they held their own with those teams. So it surprised me that this was not just a made-up team that you saw. These were real good ball players, and had it not been for the line that was drawn at the time, and gone way up to the time that Jackie Robinson came on. These guys could have been major league players too. Now let's go back to what you asked
right.
me in the first place
about the draft and what it was like, candies and flowers. Now was there someone else who had cigars?
I can relate one story to you that sticks in my mind. These guys don't know it because I never gave this story up. My old boss, one time, was what I consider a great scout and a great baseball man. He's been in baseball for over 60 years, and he's been to the top of the game and so forth. For you older fellas here, he broke into baseball with Connie Mack as his manager. And he's still active today, working every day, full-time scouting. And 2 years ago, he got sick, and he called me and said, come on over and visit me. I got an acute case of vertigo. Couldn't drive the car anymore. And he's working for Texas, and they gave him the option, stay home and just get yourself better and watch the games on TV and give us a report of anything you want to give us. So they gave him a lot of leeway there. Well, after a couple of days of this, and he was champing, and I said, you know what I'll do? I'm not doing anything. I'm retired since 1995. So I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, let's go to Baltimore. You make all the arrangements. I said, and I'll drive and I'll travel. You know, I'll make sure you get to the ball. And I did. And then from there we went to Philadelphia. And then from there we went to Boston. And you know, it was great for me. It was 2 years ago. So I'm out almost 20 years already. And meeting people again that I hadn't seen in years and years, it was a rejuvenation for me, you know, and hey, you know, you still look great, huh? Compared to what? I don't know.
Listen, you're talking about Tommy T-Bone Giordano, okay. Who is really is a great scout, and who he outslugged Hank Aaron his first year in the minors.
As a minor league player,
yeah.
Yes. And then, you know what? I've been with him, and I've seen like Hank Aaron come into a room and walk right up to him, give him a big hug, and they're the best of friends yet to this day. And T-Bone broke into the big leagues with Connie Mack as his manager. And I said, how was Connie Mack? To me, that's an icon. And it's like when I find a guy today that played for Casey Stengel, I said, how was it playing for Casey? You know, that must have been something else, you know? Well, he said, you know, it wasn't much. He slept almost through every game. He was 85 years old, and the next year he didn't come back. But T-Bone broke in with a home run against Virgil Trucks and against some other. He had two home runs in 11 games. That was his major league career. Mm-hmm. And next year he started managing it. And the rest of his story is a success story. Now, where did I go wrong here?
Listen, this is called A Conversation with Baseball Scouts. And a conversation I've been known as...
Oh, I wanted to tell a story about... I wanted to tell a story about the night that we were chasing a ball player from Hicksville High School on Long Island. He was a pretty good fastball pitcher. His name was Gary Sinosin. Did you hear that name, Bill? Okay. This goes back a while. But he was an outstanding high school pitcher. And Al Campanis was the traveling scout for the Dodgers. Traveling, I mean, he went in to see when something big was happening. And we pulled up to this kid's house this night and in Hicksville. And we stopped and we got out of the car. And that's as far as we went because we could see the light lit on the second floor. And there was Campana sitting in front of a window typing stuff out. I said, so T-Bone says, well, we're in trouble here. He said, it's just trouble. We might as well get out. So he says, I'll tell you what you do, Joe. You take the car and go park it a block or so down. He says, and I'll stay over here. He says, right next to this, and we'll see what happens. Well, he comes running back. He comes running back in about 20 minutes, and he says, okay, bring the car down here. I'm going to go in, because he left. Well, he went in, and about a half hour later, he came out with the boy. You see? Now, this is no draft. You tell him. And kid got in the car with us, and we just put on a radio station that I picked up from Kansas City. And that's the club we were working for at that time, Kansas City A's. And the kid was pitching in his first major league game. Was his father was a big timer also. But anyways, they gave him a tremendous amount of money, and he hadn't pitched in pro ball, but now he's going to pitch the first. I said, that's going to be you, Gary, right there. You see, this was perfect. This was perfect. I says, this guy was in high school 2 weeks ago. Now he's signed, and look, he's going to pitch in a big league game.
Lou Krause was that one.
That's exactly who it was. You see what I mean? It's a history.
I'm showing off. I can't help.
Get at it. But anyways, the kid never had a great career. I'm talking about Krause. He just had he was around for a while, but that was it. Well, anyways, we took Sanosian and we took him over to the beach and we put him in a beach house overnight. His class graduated without him 2 days later, and we signed him. Not fair, but all fair. What do you say? War? Whatever you want.
Love and war.
That's good.
Now, Billy and Joe Regola, you've never dealt with that situation. I mean, you have always dealt with the draft, but have you had some hijinxes that you can share?
Well, I was just going to say, when I started, there were no young scouts. It was all older men and scouts that had worked in this era without the draft. So I remember when I had started the first year, I'd gone to a game to see a high-profile prospect, and it was about the fourth or fifth inning. One of the well-known scouts gets up and says, I'm leaving. I'm going to see another game. And I was way out in the island someplace, and I'm saying to myself, there's no game that's close. Where could he be going? He's got to be going someplace. I said, there's something wrong. So I said something to one of the other scouts, one of the older guys. He says, when this game is over, you and I are going to stay in our cars, not in the parking lot. We're going to go pull behind one of those trees off the road, and we're going to sit here a while, and let's just see what happens. Well, the game ends. The two of us get in our cars. We pull off the road. We go behind the tree, and we're sitting there. And he says to me, gets in my car, and he says, watch this. The kid that we were watching was an outfielder. He never left the ballpark. He just sat there, and that scout that left in the fourth or fifth inning comes driving back into the ballpark and goes and works that kid out. And that's what these guys used to do. Joe will tell you. They used to do any kind of things. When we used to have tryout camps or whatever, they would kid some of the older guys, Al Harper or whatever. Al Harper was a longtime scout. He scouted for the Mets. He used to kid him, Al, you can come up out of the tree now. You don't have to be hiding out in the outfield. We know you're here, you know. Things like that, but those are the things that used to go on.
Joe?
The other night I spoke with you and I told you about certain scouts during that era. The scout that signed Carl Yastrzemski was Bots Nicola. Yeah. And if he didn't like you, you better stay away from him. But if he liked you, and he didn't like many people,
yeah.
I know that, because he didn't want to be friendly with anybody. That was the big thing. But for some reason, he took a liking to me. And I noticed exactly what Billy saw. And when he folded up his book in about the third or fourth inning, after he saw a guy take two at-bats, I knew he made up his mind on something right away. And I never asked him. See, the worst thing I could do was I'd say, hey, Bots, how far do you think this Yastrzemski kid's going to go? That would be the thing. That would be the end of our friendship. He would never talk to me again. He wouldn't give you that information to start with, and you'd be stupid to ask. But anyways, speaking of Yastrzemski, a school that had nine boys in it. Now you tell me, I Billy, you've run into this. Joe, you've run into. I'm moving my kid to Florida where he can play every day. We're moving to Florida. I say, you want to know something? If your kid can play, you can't hide him. You can't, because somebody's going to see him. Billy said, umpires, right? Could be groundskeepers, custodians for that school. Somebody's going to see him. You can't keep it a secret.
Tell us a little about Manny Ramirez, since you saw him.
I didn't see some people have put things in paper stories. I discovered Manny. I didn't discover him. Manny was discovered I first saw him when he was in the ninth grade. And my associate scout related to me, he said, "Joe, I saw this kid in the summertime." He says, "You got to get up there." I said, "How old is he?" "Well, I don't know," he says, "but he can play." Okay, so I went with him. And Mel Zitter was his coach at that time. And I wasn't looking at that kid. I was looking at another kid. There was a kid that, Billy, that was, Joe, I'm referring to Billy because I don't think, you were still playing someplace at that time.
No, we scouted.
No, I'm talking about, I'm talking about the kid that was on that same team, and he weighed about 90 pounds, but he was about 6'4".
He
was living in a crack house. You know what I mean?
It wasn't Louis De Los Santos, no.
No, it wasn't De Los Santos.
No, it was too,
but he was a first baseman. He was a first baseman. But anyways, it didn't take me long. In case some guy drafted him, I wanted to have something on this guy because I neglected to see him play all year. And I wanted to find out now. Well, I did find out, but that's when we saw Manny for the first time. But many people saw Manny, and I'm sure everybody did. It was, where do you want to put him in the draft? And when we sat down with Mel, and I'll tell you the story, you may have never heard this, Joe or Billy. When we sat down with Mel in George's diner February afternoon, when they were beginning their practices, and Manny came off, get off the bus, and he came in the diner, and he ate two of everything that day. Well, anyway, said to him, Mel, what are we going to do with this kid? I says, is he going to go out and play? Because Mel had good connections with junior colleges, where he didn't have to sign. And thank God for a guy like him, you know, that protected those kids. Because those kids, if you gave them $100, they probably would have ran with you, you know. But he was there to make sure that didn't happen, and he took care of his kids pretty doggone good. Well, anyways, Mel said, "Well, if he gets drafted right, he'll sign." So he said, "Okay." I said, "Would he have any objection to going to Cleveland?" He said, "No." Because you couldn't get a guy to go to Cleveland at that time. Nobody wanted to go there. And a lot of people refused. So I said, "Okay, what are you talking about?" Immediately, Tommy hit me on the shoulder and he said, "Go ahead." I said, "We're talking about the first round." And Mel said, "Wow." I'll never forget, his bottom chin went down about a foot. Because I don't think anybody spoke to him that way. And a lot of guys wanted him, but they didn't want to go to first round. And thank God for a guy like Hank Peters, who was our general manager, who had great faith in scouts and has been successful every single place he went. And his assistant at that time was John Hart, who's still around. You see him on that thing? Said, "Whatever it takes, that's the guy we're going to get." He said, "Whatever it takes."
Well, I remember that just real quick. I mean, with Manny, because I did scout him. And I remember eating in that diner afterwards, and there was some candy and flowers at one of the tables.
Let me just go with Manny. Manny played for a Sandlot organization in Brooklyn Youth Service. I've been involved with Youth Service for 40 years. And it was one January. They hold practices in January to get the season started. And that's where I had signed Sean Dunstan out of, and I had coached in youth service before I became a scout. Mel and I are very close. So it's this one January day on a Saturday, and Mel calls me up, and he says to me, "Billy, there's a kid that just came in here. He just came in from the Dominican Republic. Manny was maybe 15 years old at the time. He doesn't speak a word of English. He says, I think he's going to be better than Sean." And to me, Sean was the number one player in the country, but he had the best tools, and we always thought he was the best high school hitter. Mel would never talk about any of his players like that. And for him to come out that day when this kid was only 15 years old and tell me he's going to be the best hitter he's ever seen, He said, you better come down to the gym next week. And I went down there, and I saw Manny, and Manny was real thin at the time. He's not big like he was then. And this kid really had great bat speed. And came that year when Manny was drafted his high school year. Believe it or not, Baseball America did not have him in their top 100 players. And Joe did a great job. But that year at the draft, the Cubs picked number 11 or 12, and Cleveland picked right behind us. And I got Doug Glanville, who made it to the major leagues, and he got Manny Ramirez. So we got both kids. But that's what happened that year.
I just have a couple of things, because I have not so much a real Manny story, but that same year of the draft, if I'm not mistaken, I think he went 16th in the country. But in Manny's case, that year, the Cardinals had three first-round picks, because that's when you started, if a team signed a free agent, you're able to accumulate picks. And like Billy says, the purpose of our job as scouts is to alert our clubs and certainly, sign major league players. And in that first round, of our three picks, we liked Manny in the first round. Just pretty much where he went in that round, we had the fourth pick in the country, and we drafted Demetri Young, and he got to had a fine big league career. And then 20 and 21, I think it was a 94 draft. I'm not quite sure of the
91
year.
91.
Yeah. All right. Then the 20th and 21st pick was a right-handed pitcher by the name of Brian Barber, who got to the big leagues with the Cardinals. And he's now scouting for the Yankees. And the next pick was Alan Watson, who's a native New Yorker, and he's came out of New York Tech, a left-handed pitcher who pitched for the Cardinals and finished
Yankees.
His career with the Yankees and the Mets
for
a little bit. So we got three big leaguers, and we liked Manny. He just didn't last until there. Joe, I think Joe did a great job in scouting him and getting the signability. We talk about the draft. It's also about drafting the player. It's also about signing the player. And like I say, Joe and the candy and the flowers did a great job. They were able to do a great job of doing that. And Manny was a great hitter. Convinced me with Manny was seeing him on that youth service team with Mel Zitter. Somebody threw one almost at his head, and he fell right down to the ground in a batter's box. And sometimes, as a scout, you want to see something. How's he going to react? Well, he hit the next ball about 450 feet, and that showed me that this guy is going to hit somewhere, and he's going to play in the big leagues.
One more thing about Manny, and that is a lot of things about stories about him. How many of them are true? I don't know. How many? I got to know him pretty good. No, I think I did anyway. And I said I was fortunate. Maybe more fortunate than these guys, but because I had guys that I worked for that really loved him, and that mean a lot. Now, I said something about we said first round. We brought it right up to the table at that time. That's what I believed in right through my career. I did the same thing with other players like Charlie Nagy. I learned this from Herb Stein. How many of you people ever heard of Herb? Herb Stein, a great scout. He's passed away now. But he signed more players. We were close by each other. We had about 80 each at one time, and then we stopped. But anyways, he said, what I do is I go in and I bring my tickets with me. Here's your tickets. You're going to go to Minnesota right now. And he said, that's it. And the kid signs. And that's a good point. It's hard to get them to sign sometimes. Sometimes they got illusions of big time money and everything. Well, anyways, Charlie Nagy, I did the same thing with. I let Charlie know in the beginning, you're my number one man in my territory. Now he was pitching at UConn, and I said you're gonna be my number one man. I'm gonna do everything I can. Pete Harnish, when he was at Fordham, I told him, I says, Pete, you're my number one man. I says, and top of my list, I said, I'm going to do everything I can to get you with the Orioles. Okay? And that's what I believed in. It's just something that worked for me. But that's the way it was.
Have you heard from him since he became pitching coach for the Diamondbacks?
Pete Arnage?
No, Nagy.
No, I haven't, no.
Yeah.
But Charlie is a great person, and I got a phone call from the manager. He started off in Double A. And the very first game he pitched, I got a phone call from, he said, Joe, he says, this guy is a, using a baseball expression, not too tough. You know, everybody uses the wrong, not
yeah.
that word.
All right.
He's not tough. He's not tough enough. He's not tough enough to make it. He says, how the hell did we sign this guy? I said, let me tell you something, Bobby. And it was Bobby Molinaro, who was as tough as nails, right? And he said, he's never going to be tough enough to pitch in the big leagues. Well, till he wore his arm out, which was 128 wins later, he wasn't bad. And I had a relationship with Charlie. My scouting director came in. I went going through scouting directors like crazy. And every guy was different. Now, I go and I get a call from him and he says, I'm going to Providence to see Nagy pitch, Joe. Can you be there? I says, I'd rather not be there. I got something I got to do. I said, let me know what happens. Well, I called Nagy and I said, Nagy, scouting director from Cleveland's coming in to see you. I says, give it your good shot if you want to be an Indian. He says, oh, Jesus. He says, I never pitched good in that place. The mound is flat. There's no mound. He says, can you change? I says, I can't change it. I says, he's on the schedule. He's going to go where he wants to go. Bingo. Well, anyways, I get a call Monday. He said, Joe, I saw your boy pitch today. He's got a good arm. But some little pipsqueak hit two home runs off him over the center field fence. I said, you said it all. He's got a good arm. It's up to you now. I says, you do what you got to do. Well, anyways, Charlie kept pitching well for UConn. And now comes the word is hitting the West Coast. That Nagy is moving up and up and up and up. He's got a slider like they don't see anywhere. Well, I get a call from Giordano and he says, myself and Roberts are coming in on Saturday to see Nagy pitch against St. John's. At St. John's. You go? I said, I'll go. Okay, so I go. So I go and and then there were about the traditional 40.
I was there.
The traditional 40 guys, right? And I mean, between scouting directors, farm directors, whatnot, and scouts, it was a mob scene, and they all walked down. Not everybody, but a big contingent walked all the way down the left field line to watch him throw his warm ups, and I stayed right where I was, and then they came walking back. And then when he finished his complete warm-up, I started walking down to the left field line, and I met him on the third baseline. I said, Charlie, I said, I got the big guys here today that are going to mean more for you than anything else. I said, give it your good shot. He says, I hope to. Well, anyways, what do you do, Billy? I think he had about 18 strikeouts, 19 strikeouts.
He was very impressive that day.
And that's
good competition,
and
too.
And Britton, the guy from the Red Sox, he said, Joe, what the hell are you guys doing here today? You guys got the second pick, and this guy's going to be the 17th pick. You don't have a chance. I says, well, who knows? Well, we got him on the 17th pick, too. And the guy we picked second was a kid, a high school kid, Lewis. Remember him? Didn't do too good. And Roberts, who was one of our pitching coaches, Dave Roberts, said, we don't have a slider like that in our organization. As a matter of fact, I haven't seen one in the American League like that. He had an 86, 87 mile an hour slider. He just didn't hit that too good.
Ultimately, he threw too many. Is that that?
His elbow wore out.
Which raises another interesting question. You know, are we reaching a point where we can predict injuries, or is it everyone so different that it's very hard?
You know, as scouts, when we go to watch a pitcher, you look at mechanics and you try to predict from the mechanics if a pitcher's going to break down. But you can't really, because, for instance, my club signed Mark Pryor many years ago. And he had perfect mechanics, and yet he blew out after a couple of years, you know, from throwing so hard. I think some of the young kids throw so hard today, eventually they do break down. But the surgeries today, the Tommy John surgeries, these kids come back better than ever. And it's not a death sentence anymore. If you blow out your elbow is one thing, Tommy John, those kids come back. If you blow out your rotator cuff, that's a different story. A lot of times pitchers don't come back from that. But you can't really predict. I mean, we go out, let's say, and you watch an amateur pitcher, and you walk away from him, and you say, oh, he's got bad mechanics, he does this, he stabs in the back, he's a long armor, he's this, he's that. And then you turn your TV on, and there's a guy doing the same thing, but he made it to the big leagues for some reason or another. So you really can't tell.
Do you agree that way, Joe?
I agree. Ultimately, nobody really knows who is going to break down and get hurt. But in today's society, today's baseball world, the money is so high that there's much more extensive scrutinizing of the mechanics of a player, and especially pitching. I mean, you know, pitching. You sign for a lot of money for pitchers. The game is all about pitching. And we do a lot of filming of our free agents, and we analyze the free agents and see if their mechanics, again, as a predictability factor, the same way you'd like to predict if they're going to have success with the bat, if they're going to have success along the way. We have, you know, our pitching instructors look at the mechanics of a pitcher and maybe give some predictability that this person is going to stay healthy, or that person has the type of mechanics that we like to see, that he's going to increase his velocity. So, you know, a lot of different things go into that. And then you're going to make that. So when you make that decision, you feel you've done your homework, you've done the research, and say, hey, look, let's take this pitcher, because we're real comfortable with that. But like Billy says, you can turn on the TV and watch a ball game and say, boy, that guy doesn't have very good mechanics. But, you know, it was then. You have to look back and say, well, what was his investment that the ball club made in? I mean, if they were going to make a significant amount of money, you know, in a first-round draft choice, you know, chances are they've really done a lot of homework on it. And I can only speak for our club, but, I mean, I know we do a very extensive, you know, research and homework and try to minimize that risk of injury.
I know the question will come up from the audience, and maybe I'll raise it now. Have you read or seen Moneyball?
I had read the book, but I didn't see the movie.
Joe?
I did the same. I read the book, but I didn't see the movie, no.
And Joe Rigoli?
I did both. I just saw the Moneyball movie last week.
See, that's why he's such a great scout. You see?
I think when they fed all, you know, the numbers in the computer, they liked Albert Pujols.
And of course, that's an amazing story too. One of the Mets scouts told me when the Mets had a shot at Pujols, who was drafted in the 14th round.
Everybody had a shot.
Yeah, but they thought he was asking for too much money. I mean, he was Kansas City, that area. Did any of you see him as an amateur?
No.
No, I didn't see him. Yeah. We drafted him in the 13th round in Kansas City. He was at a junior college.
Yes.
And just to backtrack a little bit, because, you know, we read the Moneyballs and we see it in the movies, and you know, statistical and quantitative analysis is out there, and it's something that, why not, you know, look at it? Why not see the predictability factor? And I think in some rudimentary way, it was also done in years ago with on-base percentage, you know, and things like that. So it was done. People looked at stats, you know, but now I think it's even more with all the knowledge that's there as a predictability of future success. Because, you know, again, the money has gotten so much. You know, what's that player going to look like 2, 3, 4 years down the road, 6 years down the road? And I think it does have a place in the game. And, you know, we certainly analyze those things. You know, on a free agent level, I think sometimes, you know, we do it, and you have different college leagues and different high school leagues. It's a little tougher to predict that because, you know, one of the things that we find is that if we're going to see a player that we like, you know, chances are he has good stats. He's a good player. I mean, there's very few players that are drafted that didn't hit well if they were a hitter, or didn't pitch well if they were a pitcher. Now, if the pitcher was throwing 95 miles an hour and couldn't throw a strike and ended up losing every game because he walked the ballpark, that pitcher probably will get a chance to play pro ball and pitch because it's tough to teach somebody to throw 95 miles an hour. We're hoping that in the minor leagues, he can harness his command and his control, turn him over to the pitching instructors in the minor leagues, and if they can get that 95-mile-an-hour arm to throw strikes and maybe come up with a changeup or break a ball, then you've got a pretty good-looking pitcher. So, but, you know, at the free agent level, and we, you know, Billy and Joe DeLuca and myself, we've done a lot of free agent scouting. Most of the players I scouted, you know, usually did well. I mean, we weren't there to see somebody who couldn't play.
Are you satisfied with the level around here of play? Is it or are the other sports taking some of the play away from baseball? I mean, I've heard lacrosse, for instance.
The level of baseball all over the country is not as good as it used to be. The level of play in New York City is very poor. The facilities that they have to play on, the weather conditions, you know, it all contributes to that. And the kids don't play as much as they used to play. You go by the schoolyards here in the city, and at one time where they'd be bustling with activity, you don't see it anymore. But as far as the level of play, and Lee, I've seen you in Central Park at times, the city high schools are really atrocious. And if you go to, let's say, New Jersey, or you go down to Maryland, it's a lot better. The level of baseball is a lot better. And players... And you see it today in the minor leagues and the major leagues as well. You know, I don't think baseball is getting the top athletes that they used to get years ago. The problem is that as youngsters, all of a sudden they're specializing in various sports. Whereas a kid growing up, let's say I played baseball and I played basketball and I played football, and by playing the various sports, your hand-eye coordination was a lot better and whatever it might be. Today, these kids, let's say, start with a sport, let's say basketball, and where those kids might have been playing baseball during the summer for their American Legion team, all of a sudden they're playing AAU basketball during the summer. Or if they're playing football, the football coaches don't allow these kids to play baseball in the spring. They have spring practice. So some of the kids that would get an opportunity years ago to maybe try another sport, they're not getting the chance to play baseball anymore. And we're losing athletes because of it. And not every kid is going to play in the NBA, and not every kid is going to play in the NFL because of size. You know, you go back to size, it's a big factor. With some of those kids are real good athletes. You get a defensive back from football that can play center field or the outfield in baseball or someplace else, and baseball's not getting a chance to have these athletes taste the sport. So the level of competition is really not as good. And I see players in the minor leagues that are in double and triple A that probably wouldn't have gotten that a rookie ball or A ball years ago. But they're filtering to the higher levels, and a couple of those guys are now filtering into the major leagues. And that's why you see the level of play that you see at the major league level.
You feel that way too, Joe DeLuca?
To an extent I do. It depends on the section of the country you're in. Where they play, I've seen some real good play in Florida in the public high schools. Some real good base, much better than up here, that's for sure. But it seems like the promises are made to young athletes: we get you a scholarship to college, you know, and bingo. They get lacrosse. They get that nice scholarship, and the parents don't have to spend 10 cents, you know, because everybody wants it in their college, and they got a head start, and they denigrate baseball too. I hate to say that, but they're not good people when they do that. I never denigrated anybody's sport. I never spoke bad about lacrosse or somebody else's sport. There are certain sports that don't combine. Like wrestling, high school wrestling does not combine with only. I never saw a good champion wrestler that was a pretty good baseball player. I never saw that. Matter of fact, my own son was a pretty good high school baseball player, but then when he reached his sophomore year, he says, "That's it, I'm giving it up. I don't want to be a football player anymore either." I want you to buy me a clam boat. And do you know what the clam guys do? They stand on the side of the boat, and it's this much off the water, and they use tongs. And they build up arm strength that you can't believe. And he became a champion wrestler, high school wrestler. But the other sports went. That's what you wanted to do? Fine. Go ahead. You can do it. Go ahead. But I agree with Billy, yes, that the baseball here, but what I've noticed here, Billy, more than anything else, is the schools have turned to almost all Latin players in the city. Am I right or wrong?
Years ago, a good number of the Latin players were from Puerto Rico. No more. They're all from the Dominican Republic. There's been a big shift in the population. And that's what you're getting here in the city. And those kids love to play. But as a scout, I was smart. I knew not to go early in the spring because they don't like to play in the cold weather. So you wait until the weather warmed up as you got closer to the draft. And the kids would play. But the one thing that you do see here in the Northeast is that for some reason the Northeast develops pitchers. Not so much position players. Maybe because of the repetition, the at-bats, they're not getting them. But it just seems that when we would sign pitchers here in the Northeast, those kids would just all of a sudden blossom when they got into pro ball, probably from instruction and probably from the innings and probably playing under better weather conditions.
Hey, Joe, I want to ask you, have you been to San Domingo recently?
I
haven't either, but what I've noticed is this. Now, look at the size of Pujols. There's one big guy. Look at the size of some of these pitchers that are coming out of the Dominican. Where are they finding these guys? I mean, these guys are a moose and a half. You know, when we had our dinner last year, and that kid sat in the next table next to me, I said, that guy's got to be a pitcher. It was Betances.
It was Betances. But we have Dellin Betances and Pedro Beato both played on this youth service team together.
Yeah.
And they also had your first round pick from the Cardinals. You took the kid out of Northeastern.
Out of Ottavino.
Can you imagine this on a Sandlot team? You had Beato, Betances, and Ottavino. All these kids are 6'5 and better. Betances is now 6'9. Imagine walking off the bus for the Sandlot team.
This guy's got to be a pitcher. Look at this guy's going to be a pitcher.
We're going to wind up the first round here, then we're going to bring in the audience, okay? But it's been a conversation that I had dreamed of, and it's thank you, Billy Blitzer, Joe DeLuca, and Joe Rigoli, and Lee Longfish just saying, don't touch that dial.
Before you go to that,